Hey, it's Danny Pellegrino from Everything Iconic. Ready to upgrade your style game without blowing your budget? Check out Quince. They've got all the good stuff, shirts and polos, activewear and fine leather goods, all at 50 to 80% less than other high-end brands. And the best part? They're all about safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get that luxury vibe without the luxury price tag. Hit up quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. That's quince.com/upgrade.
Burrow is a furniture company known for timeless design and thoughtful construction, and free shipping, and that extends to their outdoor collection. Their outdoor furniture is built to withstand the elements, featuring rust-proof stainless steel hardware, weather-ready teak, and quick-dry foam cushions. For Memorial Day, get 15% off your Burrow purchase at burrow.com/acast and up to 25% off outdoor. That's up to 25% off outdoor furniture at burrow.com/acast.
Hi, everybody. Welcome to Dan Snow's History Hit. Things are getting exciting. I'm talking to you on Monday, the 23rd of November, 2020. We've just had the preliminary results announced from AstraZeneca and Oxford University's vaccine for COVID-19. They look fairly optimistic, thus joining two other companies who have announced results. We are expecting vaccines to be delivered into the arms of people before the end of December 2020. That's a record, folks. It's a record. From identifying a virus to having a vaccine to deal with it in less than 11 months. I was joined on this podcast by an absolute card-carrying legend, Paul Offit. He's an American paediatrician. He specializes in infectious diseases, vaccines, immunology, virology, got all that. He's the co-inventor of a vaccine. I mean, that's big time. The co-inventor of the rotavirus vaccine. He's a professor at the Perelman School of Medicine at the University of Pennsylvania. He is a member of the Center for Disease Control's, the CDC's, Advisory Committee on Immunization Practices. He's a total dude. And he's also a wonderful scholar of the history of vaccination programs in the US and around the world. I want to talk to him about the huge campaign to immunize kids against polio, the tragedy and the triumph of that campaign that saw unsafe vaccines given to hundreds of thousands of kids, whilst millions more were successfully vaccinated. It feels like an important time to be talking about the history of vaccine development, safety, rollout, everybody. Here we go. Enjoy. If you want to go and watch as many history shows as you can possibly stomach, go to History Hit TV. It's like Netflix for history, a new digital history channel we got going on. It's all kicking off over there at the moment. It'd be great to have you subscribe. If you use the code POD1, P-O-D-1, you get a month for free. Your second month is £1, euro or dollar. Inoculate yourself against boredom by heading over to History Hit TV so you can watch history documentaries. There's also something of a debate has broken out on the Twitter feed. I mean, I'm surprised this is happening. We're selling out of knight's helmets at the moment, knitted knight's helmets, but we've been told they are not knitted knight's helmets. They are, in fact, crocheted knight's hats. You can get involved in that debate if you want at historyhit.com/debate. It's a thing that is now happening, apparently. But in the meantime, everyone, enjoy Paul Offit. Paul, thanks so much for coming on the podcast.
My pleasure.
It's a huge day. It's a huge month at the moment for vaccines. We'll get on a bit more to the contemporary scene in a second. But let's go back. Let's talk about polio. Just how much of a spectre. People have forgotten today what polio was like as a haunting prospect in the mid-century, the mid-20th century everywhere in the world.
Yeah, I mean, I think there are many parallels, actually, from the polio story in the mid-50s to today. One is, parents were scared to death of this virus. I mean, it could paralyze 30,000, 40,000 children a year. It could kill 1,500 children a year, this virus. And what made it particularly heinous, aside from its unique capacity to permanently harm children, was most of the transmission was asymptomatic. You didn't know who you were getting it from, just like SARS-CoV-2 today, where you don't know really where it's coming from. So therefore, you're scared of everyone. The second thing was that in the race to make a vaccine, that was really warp speed one, because, you know, basically it wasn't the government, but it was the March of Dimes in the United States, the so-called National Foundation for Infantile Paralysis, that said, we'll pay for the phase three trial. We'll pay the millions and millions of dollars for a phase three trial. We'll pay for five companies to make it at risk, not knowing whether it's safe, not knowing whether it's effective. We'll pay for all that. That's what speeded it up. The same reason that this has been speeded up. So there are definitely parallels. And it was a shared national tragedy that was handled that way. So
my mum's family were in Toronto in the 1950s and got wiped out from one dinner party. Several members of the same family developed terrible lifelong, one died and several developed lifelong complications as a result of getting polio. It seemed that there were surges of polio. Does it work like a pulmonary pandemic? Does it kind of come and go, or was it just there all the time?
No, polio was there all the time. There were three different strains that caused polio. And sometimes one or another strain circulated, but there was polio every year. Every summer meant polio in the United States. I mean, it started to really rear its head in the 30s and 40s with industrialization, actually, is what happened. I mean, the polio was always around. And what would happen is, you know, everybody got infected. Mothers got infected. They would passively transfer their antibodies that they had from that infection to their newborn. And then because newborns or kids in the first year of life or so would get exposed to polio, it was sort of like this passive active immunity. The antibodies from their mother protected them, and then they would get this active immune response from the virus itself. So they were protected. What happened with industrialization is that the incidence of polio then started to decrease as people were sanitation improved. So now you weren't exposed to polio until you were 5, 6, 7 years of age, and the antibodies you may have gotten from your mother had gone away. So that's when you saw the 5 to 9 year old outbreaks of polio.
And what happened in the mid-1950s? Why was there such an effort around this vaccine push? Was it the technology had changed? The money became available? What was it about that key period?
Well, the technology had changed. The thing with polio is it reproduces itself in nervous system cells, like cells of the brain, cells of the spinal cord. If you make a vaccine using cells from the brain and spinal cord, you always run the risk of inducing an immune response against the protein that sort of serves as the sheathing of nerve cells, you know, like the rubber sheathing of a wire. Of an electrical wire. And so a protein was called myelin basic protein. So when you inoculated people with that, with this sort of nervous tissue derived polio viruses, you could induce this immune response against your own nervous system, essentially, which could cause paralysis, it could cause coma, it could cause death. It was a problem. So that was solved by a group at Harvard headed by John Enders, where they showed you could grow poliovirus in non-nervous system cells, cells like monkey kidney cells. And with that, you could now, that sort of opened up the field to be able to make a vaccine by the early 50s.
And are those breakthroughs taking place? Is there government involvement? Is there government leadership in those vaccines? Or is this just departments at universities, specialists just pursuing this out of their own, for their own research interests?
You talk about with polio or with today?
With polio.
No, well, there were polio vaccines in the 20 years before the Salk vaccine in 1950s. In the 1930s, there were two polio vaccines, one made by Maurice Brodie in New York, the other by John Colmer in Philadelphia, which failed. They actually caused polio because in both cases, although they tried to inactivate the virus with a chemical, in both cases, they failed. So there were children who got that vaccine who got polio from the vaccine. That set the program back about 20 years, really.
Wow. And then we get the great success of this polio vaccine in the mid-1950s, how big was that national immunization push?
It was huge. First of all, the study that was done involved giving 420,000 children the vaccine, giving 200,000 children placebo. That was and then 1.2 million children served as observed uninoculated controls. That was a 1.8 million child study. No medical product, I think, has ever been tested to such a at such a level. I mean, I think if that kind of, if a 1.8 million child study was done today, I think it would cost $6 billion, really. And we mass, you know, five companies stepped forward to mass produce it at risk. It was just an amazing national effort. And it was truly national. I mean, the March of Dimes was a private philanthropic organization where people would send their dimes in to support this. It was our vaccine. It was America's vaccine. It was the American public's vaccine, even more so than pharmaceutical companies. We paid for that vaccine. And so we felt it was our vaccine.
And then there was, however, when you mentioned these private companies that were helping to mass produce it, there was one disaster.
Right. So five companies were selected to make that vaccine. One company, Cutter Laboratories of Berkeley, California, made it badly. What they failed to do was they failed to fully inactivate the poliovirus that was in the vaccine for a number of reasons. And what happened then was that about 120,000 children in the West and Southwest were inoculated with live, fully virulent poliovirus, thinking it was a poliovirus vaccine. About 40,000 of those children developed abortive or short-lived polio, meaning transient weakness, transient paralysis. About 164 were permanently paralyzed, and 10 were killed. I think it was the worst biological disaster in this country's history. And it wasn't just Qatar. Wyeth Laboratories also made a vaccine that paralyzed and killed children, just not nearly to that extent. I think more reasonably, it could have been called the scale-up incident. We just weren't very good at going from sort of 10 or 100 or 1,000 doses to tens of millions of doses. That's the hardest part of vaccines. I mean, as many people say in the vaccine world, the hardest part of making vaccines is making vaccines. I mean, you have to scale them up and make sure that it looks exactly like it did when you were working with it in your laboratory. And that's hard.
Well, that seems like a fairly important lesson from history today. Let's talk about what the impact, the legacy of that terrible, the Qatar incident. What was the effect that had on public health policy and delivery in the U.S. and elsewhere?
Right, well, it was the birth of vaccine regulation in the United States. We went from about 10 people in the federal government who oversaw vaccines to 150 within a very short period of time. It was the birth of something called consistency lots, which still exists today, where you show you have to make a certain number of lots of vaccine that have the exact same biological characteristics. See, the hard thing about making vaccines is they're biologicals. They're not small molecule drugs. I mean, if you make, for example, amoxicillin, it's very easy to say I have 50 milligrams of amoxicillin in this tablet from this batch and 50 milligrams of amoxicillin in this tablet from this batch. But biologicals, really, the process is the product. And so it's the process that gets regulated. It's hard to characterize it otherwise.
So therefore, a whole new regulatory system is introduced as a result of this.
That's right. It was the birth of vaccine regulation in the United States. And as is invariably true, there's a historian named Michael Harris who said that the history of drug regulation is built on tombstones. And that's always true.
Now, what effect did it have on the public? I mean, is this the beginning of a sort of a mis... Well, not beginning, but do we see any impact on a kind of mistrust of scientists, a mistrust of big government regulation, the anti-vax movement? Was Qatar instance important in that respect?
Interestingly, not at all. Qatar went to court. I mean, obviously, they were held accountable for their tragic mistake, and they went to court again and again. But if you look at the exit interviews with the people who served on juries, they actually wanted to find Qatar not guilty or not negligent. The reason being that they thought it was a process of evolution. The defense explained correctly that it wasn't only Qatar that had a problem, that all of the vaccine makers had difficulties in activating the virus on a mass scale. And so the jurors intelligently reasoned that this was a evolutionary process and that we just hadn't gotten to the point of evolution in the science to be able to say that Qatar in any sense knowingly made a mistake. You know, the safety tests weren't really there yet. The capacity to mass produce consistently wasn't there yet. It just wasn't there yet. And the jurors realized that. And it had very little impact, I think, on the public. The public generally trusted pharmaceutical companies. I know it's hard to imagine there ever was a time like that. Basically, the public believed that the pharmaceutical manufacturers were doing the best they could. And in fact, I mean, the people at Qatar Laboratories who made that vaccine gave it to their own children. They didn't think anything was wrong, obviously.
I'm Professor Susanna Lipscomb, and on Not Just the Tudors from History Hit, I'm looking for answers to the big questions about every aspect of life in the early modern period. Like, how did the memory of Anne Boleyn continue to influence the court of her daughter, Elizabeth I? How were fairies brought to life on the Elizabethan stage? And how did the arrival of male-only doctors threaten the lives of women? In other words, not just the Tudors, but most definitely also the Tudors. Twice a week, every week. Subscribe now and follow me on Not Just the Tudors from History Hit, wherever you get your podcasts.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Looking for the perfect gift to celebrate the moms in your life? Aura frames are beautiful, Wi-Fi connected digital picture frames that allow you to share and display unlimited photos. It's super easy to upload and share photos via the Aura app. And if you're giving an Aura as a gift, you can even personalize the frame with preloaded photos and memories. And also remember, when you use a messaging app, they shrink the photos. You cannot print those out. You cannot blow them up. This is high quality imagery going to one of the most important people in your life. The Aura app is super easy to set up. It takes about 2 minutes and you're going to love it. There's free unlimited storage, add unlimited photos and videos, and invite as many people as you want to a frame. Right now, Aura has got a great deal for Mother's Day. Listeners can save on the perfect gift by visiting auraframes.com to get $30 plus free shipping on their best-selling frame. That's AURAframes.com. Use code DANSNOW at checkout to save. Terms and conditions apply. And following on to the birth of vaccine regulation, how's that worked? I mean, if you look back at the 7 decades that have followed that, has it been a success?
Yes, I think so. It was really almost 50 years before another vaccine was withdrawn because of an issue of safety. There was a vaccine in the late 1990s to prevent a virus called rotavirus, which is a common cause of fever, vomiting, and diarrhea in babies, that was found to be a very rare cause of intestinal blockage called intussusception. This vaccine was on the market for about 10 months when it was very quickly found to cause a problem, and then it was off the market. And that's really been it. In terms of safety, that's probably been the only real safety issue. And even there, the incidence was about 1 per 30,000 vaccinees. And certainly far more children died, even in the United States every year, of rotavirus than would have ever been hurt by that vaccine. But nonetheless, we were intolerant of any severe side effects, so that vaccine came off the market till it was replaced by a better, safer vaccine 7 years later.
So that does sound like, though, that there's still no, you tell me, there's no magic, but there's no silver bullet on vaccine. A lot of this is just observing its effect in human beings and then drawing judgment from that.
It's always trial and error. You never know about whether or not something works until you put it in people. That's always true. I mean, for people in the vaccine world, the old expression is mice lie and monkeys exaggerate. You never really know until you put it in people.
And so how are you feeling about today? And first of all, we heard so much, didn't we, at the beginning of this outbreak in January, February. It takes, what is the record speed at which a vaccine has gone from identifying the threat to delivery in the doctor's surgery?
Right. So from having a virus in hand to a commercial product, the fastest vaccine would be the mumps vaccine, which was that virus was isolated by the researcher who made that vaccine, Maurice Hilleman, in 1963. That was then a vaccine 4 years later. But there were a lot of things you could do then that you couldn't do now. I mean, you tested it in far fewer people then. You would test the vaccine in 5,000, 6,000 people before it would get a license. The licensing process was very fast. As is seen from now, where it's much slower. So this virus was in hand in the United States anyway and sequenced in January of 2020. This will be a vaccine very likely that rolls off the assembly line into the arms of the American public and the world probably by the end of December. 1 year. Remarkable.
That is. And what about the safety? What about the fact that you haven't observed it in enough people? Are you feeling, has that speed, this is obviously the big question, but has that speed involved compromising on safety?
So if you look at the size of the trials, Moderna's is a 30,000-person study. Pfizer's is a 44,000-person study. Johnson & Johnson is a 60,000-person study. AstraZeneca also is in the tens of thousands. That's typical for any vaccine. That's typical for any pediatric vaccine. So if that's true, why not just submit these vaccines for licensure like you always do and just get a biological license application like you always do and get licensed? And the reason is the length of the trial. I mean, the human papillomavirus vaccine was a 30,000-person trial, but it was a 7-year trial. I mean, the rotavirus vaccine that we worked on at Children's Hospital of Philadelphia was a 70,000-person study, but it was a 4-year study. But you're not going to do a 3 or 4 year study for this vaccine. I mean, when it's already killed, say, 250,000 people this year in the United States, you're not going to wait to make sure that it's effective, not only for a couple months, which is what you're going to know. I mean, when Pfizer's vaccine, and Moderna's vaccines, or AstraZeneca's vaccine, or Johnson & Johnson's vaccine are approved through emergency use authorization, you're only going to know that they were effective for a couple months. You're not going to know whether it was effective for 6 months or a year. On the other hand, you're not going to test it for that long because you can't afford to. So are you taking a risk? Have you reduced a critical amount of uncertainty by saying, okay, I know it's effective for a couple months. Is it likely it'll be effective for 6 months or a year? And I think the answer is yes. So then the question becomes safety. Well, the rule is, at least in the United States, that you have to test at least half of the vaccine group for at least 2 months after the last dose. Is that enough time to figure out whether or not you have a serious side effect problem? If you look at the history of serious side effects from vaccines, and there certainly are serious side effects from vaccines, like, for example, a disease called Guillain-Barré syndrome, which is this ascending paralysis that occurs in roughly 1 per million doses of influenza vaccine, or narcolepsy, a disorder of wakefulness that was caused by a squalene adjuvanted influenza vaccine that was given in Europe during 2009-2010, or polio caused by the polio vaccine. Albert Sabin's oral polio vaccine, but roughly one per every 2.4 million doses, was complicated by paralysis. The measles-containing vaccine can cause a lowering of the platelet count, which can cause you to have these sort of little showers of broken blood vessels. The yellow fever vaccine can essentially cause something that has a fancy name of viscerotropic disease, which is a nice way of saying yellow fever. I mean, the yellow fever vaccine is a rare cause of something like yellow fever. That, too, occurs roughly 1 per million doses. All of those awful side effects occur within 6 weeks of getting a vaccine. So I think by waiting 2 months, you have, again, reduced a critical amount of uncertainty. Plus, you know, you are going to have systems in place like the Vaccine Adverse Events Reporting System in the U.S., the Vaccine Safety Data Link, something called VSAFE, which is an active program that's run by the CDC where you call people on their phone to make sure that they're okay after they've gotten a vaccine. So I think that we have reduced a critical amount of uncertainty by bringing these vaccines even this quickly. The reason it's so quick is that the pharmaceutical companies basically had the risk taken out of it for them by the government. I mean, the government said, we'll pay for phase three trials, we'll pay for mass production. I mean, companies would never do it that way. The companies would say, we'll do the phase three trial, and if it works, then we'll mass produce it. We're not going to mass produce it at risk.
So the interesting thing is, for an idiot like me, I assume maybe there was some like supercomputer that was just crunching data quicker. Have we reached the inelastic point past which we're not going to get more speedy vaccines? Because we've got to let this work through these human trials.
That's correct. You always have to test in human. You have to do that. You can't get to the point, I think, where you have a computer simulation, at least not now, where you say, this is, I can now accurately predict that this will work in X percentage of people. It'll be this percentage effective. It will have this safety problem that's occurring at this rate. We're not there yet. No.
And so historically, what will be the legacy of, what do you think the legacy of what is what we're going through at the moment? Is it just a less than what can be achieved when you apply an unlimited amount of money to a traditional practice creating vaccines, or have we pioneered new ways that will be deeply significant the next time we get one of these pandemics?
I think both. I mean, I think the amount of money we put into this dramatically drove this process to be much faster. And we'll see. I mean, you know, the messenger RNA vaccine that's being used, the DNA vaccines, these replication defective human adenoviruses or replication defective simian adenoviruses, or these replication competent other viruses that are being used as sort of a Trojan horse to bring that SARS-CoV-2 spike protein into the cell, are all pretty novel strategies. I mean, there's no commercial experience with some of them and very little commercial experience with others, and none in the developed world. So we're going to learn a lot, I think, over the next couple of years. I mean, if you take a step back, here's what you have. You have a bat coronavirus that just made its debut in the human population a year ago that has caused a number of things that no one would have ever predicted. You would have never predicted it would cause you to, say, have a weeks-long loss or many weeks-long loss of smell, taste, which says that the virus at some level is going up into your brain, that causes vasculitis, meaning inflammation of blood vessels. And because every organ in your body has a blood supply, every organ can be affected. I mean, what respiratory virus that's typically a winter respiratory virus like influenza or parainfluenza or respiratory syncytial virus. That's how this virus was built. This virus was built out of Wuhan as a winter respiratory virus that causes pneumonia. It causes far more than that. It can cause strokes, heart attacks, kidney disease, liver disease. It causes a very unusual disease in children, this so-called multi-system inflammatory disease of children. I've never seen that before, caused by a virus. I mean, so you have this difficult to characterize virus, which already has a number of clinical surprises and pathological surprises that you are about to meet with a series of vaccine strategies with which we have no commercial experience. I think it's fair to say that we are going to learn a lot over the next couple of years. Some things we would have wished we knew now. So we have to be humble, be open-minded, that when you don't know things, you have to be humble and see how it plays out.
You're going to get a vaccine, right?
You bet. I mean, I'm a person of a certain age, i.e. over 65, who's at risk of this disease. I mean, I want to see the data. I mean, right now we're in science by press release time. We will see the data. I'm actually on the FDA's Vaccine Advisory Committee. On December 10th, we will meet and we will go over Pfizer's vaccine. And I then will see all the data. Actually, before then, I'll see all the data. And so I'll have a much better sense of whether this vaccine meets up to its billing.
Well, this is an audio-only podcast, but I can tell you, listeners, that I am looking at Paul right now, and I'll tell you, he's not being honest with us because he's taken the youth drug as well, because he does not look like he's over 65, Paul. I think you've got some other drugs up your sleeve you need to approve, buddy. Thank you very much for coming on this podcast. It's been incredible. Thank you for giving the historical context to this important moment.
Thank you. It's my pleasure.
I feel the hand of history upon our shoulders.
Of ours, our school history, our songs, this part of the history of our country, all were gone and finished and liquidated.
Hope you enjoyed the podcast. Just before you go, bit of a favour to ask. I totally understand if you don't want to become a subscriber or pay me any cash money. Makes sense. But if you could just do me a favour, it's for free. Go to iTunes or wherever you get your podcast. If you give it a 5-star rating and give it an absolutely glowing review, purge yourself, give it a glowing review. I'd really appreciate that. It's a tough world out there, law of the jungle out there. And I need all the fire support I can get. So that will boost it up the charts. It's so tiresome. But if you could do it, I'd be very, very grateful. Thank you.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Did you know cats tend to hide symptoms of sickness and pain? I learned this the hard way after losing my cat, Gingy. So I created Pretty Litter, a health monitoring litter that helps detect early signs of illness by changing colors, saving you money and potentially your cat's life. Pretty Litter is veterinarian developed, and it's the easiest way to keep tabs on your fur baby's health right at home.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And is all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Thank you for listening to this episode of Dan Snow's History It. Please follow this show wherever you get your podcasts. It really helps us, and you'll be doing us a big favour. Don't forget, you can also listen to all of these podcasts ad-free and watch hundreds of TV documentaries when you subscribe at historyhit.com/subscribe. As a special gift, you can also get your first 3 months for just £1 a month when you use code DANSNOW at checkout.